Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black. Tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
Good evening. You are live with Tex and Rex, irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host for Rhino Free Radio, Rex, broadcasting to you from the Ninth Circle of Hell, otherwise known as I-495, the Capitol Beltway around Washington, D.C.
And this is Tex, broadcasting from Houston, Texas. Once again, and looks like Election Day is tomorrow, so everybody can
Election
go.
Eve.
Yes, we can go out and vote for which of the one of the two candidates they hate the least, or they could actually vote for somebody who most closely believes what they believe, or you could write in whoever the heck you want. I mean, it should work that way. In some states it does, in some states it doesn't. If it doesn't work that way in your state, what the heck's wrong with your state?
Fix it.
So tomorrow's the day. If you haven't already voted, you know, head out to the polls tomorrow and register your disgust with the direction that the country is going, and hopefully with the two idiotic choices that have been given to you. So, Rex, there was a debate tonight, or something calling itself a debate. There definitely were differences of opinion expressed in
yeah.
the free and equal debate. What were your thoughts before I give my thoughts? So back to you.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. First, free and sort of equal. I mean, the first free and equal debate back, I think it was on the 23rd, had all four alternate party candidates who have access to 270 electors, and I thought it was actually pretty good. Of course, because there's four of them, we only got through about six questions, and I think a follow-up debate with all four would have been fantastic. But alas, Free and Equal, for some reason, decided to do to an online poll, and it was Johnson and Stein. Oddly enough, Stein got advertising and more talk time, kind of odd. Or maybe not, because it was actually they had the debate here in D.C. at the studios of RT TV, which is Russian television. So I'm inclined to think that they might have favored the left-leaning candidate. But besides the point, we had a good debate last night, which we talked about on the show, that Ralph Nader put on at Busboys and Poets with all four candidates. Unfortunately, the audio sucked, so that was kind of a problem. But yeah, Tex, you're right. It's election eve, and everybody should go out and vote tomorrow. Unfortunately, well, a third of those who will vote have already voted. So the two-thirds of you that haven't voted, don't screw up. Go to the polls. And if you can, grab one of the 90 million people who are not voting at all. Get them to the polls and get them to vote for the alternate parties. Now, before we get into the debate, Tex, I just want to point out something to everybody, because we've talked about it before, but I think it's pretty important tonight. Voting for the alternate party is not about winning this race. It is possible that one of them will actually be the third considered candidate in a House decision due to no one getting 270 electors, but I would not hold my breath for that outcome. But it's important because we know that more than likely tomorrow, well, maybe not tomorrow, but maybe the next day or next week, depending on how it works out, one of the corporatist candidates of the duopoly will win. It'll either be the reelection of the illegitimate president, Barack Obama, or the illegitimate nominee of the Republicans, Mitt Romney, and nothing will change. So if you want to see change, the only opportunity that we have is 2014 and 2016, which means you've got to set it up and start working for it now, because the forces that are allied against us are well-entrenched and well-funded. What does that mean, setting it up? Well, in many states, in order for parties to have ballot access, they need a percentage of the vote. It could be as little as 1%. It could be as high as 10%. Find out the rules in your state. But either way, by turning out for these alternate candidates, we will be establishing other parties to have easier and cheaper ballot access next time round, so we won't find ourselves right back here again with this lesser of two evils bullshit. So you've got to go vote for those alternate party candidates. Now, if you're thinking, oh, but goodness, if I vote for someone other than Romney, then Obama will win. Or if I vote for someone other than Obama, Romney will win. It's not likely that our audience and the people that you know are going to decide this election, especially if you don't live in one of the 9 or 11 swing states. So help the cause of liberty by voting for an alternate party that most resembles your political principles. And that's very, very important to do. It's the best thing that you can do. And realize that that'll actually force your party, which ostensibly for most people listening is the Republican Party, to possibly become more conservative, or actually conservative, because you gave your vote to fiscal conservative Johnson or all-around conservative Good, or you wrote in Dr. Ron Paul. That'll actually make them think, wow, you know, these people – because, look, even if the votes are, quote, rigged, don't think for a second that the oligarchy doesn't know how the vote actually went. And if they see that a significant portion of us went alternate party, especially towards the conservative end of the spectrum, that will mean that they will have to court us in the next elections, which will make the Republican Party actually have to possibly run some real conservatives or lie better, one or the other. So I think it's very important for everybody to do that, and that's why I think, despite the fact that it was on Russian television, Tex, and the fact that it was only Stein and Johnson, it was a relatively interesting debate because we kind of had two different visions. Now, when I say two different visions, clearly they didn't talk about issues where they would either have agreement.
I think you used the most term liberally, especially in one case, but anyway, go ahead.
yeah, maybe perhaps too much. But they, it was at least two relatively different views vis-a-vis the economy and the nature of government. Now, obviously, we didn't talk about issues important to all-around conservatives, and especially moral conservatives with Christian values who are looking at pro-life and things like that, because clearly gay marriage, abortion, drugs is not really a area where these two would have any significant debate. What I found interesting, what I'd like to focus on, is the difference in their view of the role of government vis-a-vis the economy. And I saw two different visions. There's one, which is ostensibly labeled the left or the liberal vision, by Green Party candidate Dr. Jill Stein, which is pretty much identifying a lot of the problems that we have going on, the excessive spending, the wars, the unemployment, that kind of stuff. But the solution seems to be more government intervention, more command and control economy, and more redistribution of wealth, although her idea of
that always works.
Wealth, yeah, the redistribution of wealth from those who produce it to those who don't produce it. And the oligarchy's, the corporatist view of redistribution of wealth is redistribution of wealth from those who are not a political constituency, from those who produce to those who are the financiers of production, which is an even smaller pool and concentrates wealth illicitly because it uses the force of government. Johnson, on the other hand, although not extremely articulately, did make the case for free markets. And I would bring the debate down to that.
Rex, I'm just going to throw this out there because, you know, you mentioned this, and I was listening to Jill Stein speak, but do you think she even understands where the money comes from and about banking interest and all this kind of stuff? I mean, she was spouting off multi-trillion-dollar promises left and right, creating an entire industry out of her own imagination, And how is she going to finance that? Oh, well, the government must have the money. It has a pot of gold somewhere that it can get the money from. I mean, I don't think she understands where the money comes from. I don't think she understands what the cost of these things are. I don't think she understands that she, let's just say in her dream world, she did become president. She started implementing these things. I don't think she has even the slightest concept that she would be delivered straight into the hands of the Wall Street banks in order to finance this thing. Oh, and by the way, it's completely unfinanceable because you cannot create an industry out of nothing where you are both creating the suppliers of the good by paying for them. So you're paying the suppliers of the good through subsidies and taxes on other industries and that kind of stuff, paying to create that thing, and then at the same time paying to create a consumer for a good that they don't actually want. So you're subsidizing the purchase of this. You've completely created a fantasy industry. And if you're a banker, that's great because it means more debt. And then when inevitably it fails, as inevitably it will because it's not a real industry, you come back to the bank and guess what? They restructure your loan for a big fee. And then they give you a whole new payment schedule. Now you got even more debt because it's been rescheduled. I mean, that entire concept lost on her. I mean, I think most concepts were lost on her, but it's just she did not betray any sense that she had even the slightest clue of what she was talking about or what the effects of what she was talking about would be.
I think she was advocating for a unicorn in every yard and a rainbow over every house and that she can somehow magically change the weather.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the Department of Weather. Actually, I wrote something down specifically about that.
That's exciting.
Well, yeah, I'll come back to that because now I got to find her quote in all these notes. But look, yeah, oh yeah, she said that if you vote for me, if you vote for the Green Party, we will bring this catastrophic. We'll bring climate change to an end. Oh, okay, if you vote Green Party, apparently you'll stop the weather. Then the climate won't change anymore. I mean,
well, I don't know how the hell would that happen?
I mean, how irrational do you have to be to say these things, and second, be a voter and believe in, yes, I want to vote and stop the climate from changing. I can do this with my vote. No, you can't. You're an idiot. You know, she went to Harvard. Starting to wonder about that school. Anyway, go ahead.
You are? But didn't Obama and Romney go to Harvard?
Starting to wonder about that school. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, here's the interesting thing. First of all, what someone who will probably call you a climate change denier would say, weather and climate are not the same thing. Yes, they're not. That's a fact. But, you know, give us a little latitude for irreverent hyperbole in the simple fact that even if it is climate change is occurring, which ostensibly climate change is always occurring, the jury is out on whether it is or is not man-made. But what we do know for a fact is that even if it is man-made, eliminating every single man-made carbon emission will change absolutely nothing. Now, when we've got 22%+ unemployment, when we've got trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see, $16 trillion in public debt, $200 trillion in unfunded total government liabilities, which is more than the entire wealth that the planet has ever produced, and we've got jihadi terrorists trying to kill us. We're involved in, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 maybe wars that are undeclared by Congress. I think we got bigger problems to worry about than whether the sea level rises 3 millimeters or if the mean temperature increases by a half a degree. Would you agree with that text?
She was on about this. And the ice sheets in Greenland are retreating faster than the climate models even predicted. And it's actually worse than they predict. No, the climate models predicted like this rocketing, you know, level of global warming. And if you look since 1998, it's basically been flatlined. The models are completely wrong because here's how the models work. They go create the model, right, based on previous data, and so they go create it, and then they have the model predict. And then the next year, when the model's completely freaking wrong, right, I mean, that'd be like me predicting the oil price next year, right? I don't know. the oil market's made of millions of people making a bunch of independent, irrational decisions. It's complete chaos. You can't model chaos. That's kind of the concept behind chaos. And so the temperature just starts going up and up. And then the next year, it didn't do that, right? So then they go fix the model to match the data, and then, oh, yeah, but now it's right. Well, it's never right. It's completely wrong. I've seen these things. That's all I'm saying. It's stupid, okay?
You're making
I worked
much
in the
sense.
Department that came up with this crap.
You got to ease into this. You can't take me from that debate that we just saw and just hit me with all this logic all at once. You kind of got to ease me into it. But since I would
I was listening for like an hour and a half, and my head was going to explode. I mean, most of what I wrote down was like Jill Stein stuff. I'm like, you know, Gary Johnson, I thought he, you know, got in good stride there, and he was kind of laying some blows, like that's a bunch of baloney and all this.
Yeah,
stuff.
I like
you know,
the baloney
I was like,
line.
Yeah.
That was good. Yeah, that was good.
That was good. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, Tex, I'd really like to focus on the socialist view of economics and the free market view of economics, and then put that up against the corporatist view, which is shared by Obama and by Romney, although one of them has a Marxist bent and the other one has a more capitalist bent. When I say capitalist, I'm not talking about free market capitalism, but about the private deployment of capital. I think that's where we need to focus. However, since we're on this green stuff and we're talking Green Party, I'd like to get that out of the way first, predominantly because we have a guest that I'm bringing on who has an affinity for this subject, and it is one of the few areas where we sometimes find some slight disagreement, which makes for good debate, which is what we should have. So online with us is Robert Jetter of Bart's Logic Political Talk. Robert, would you like to chime in on Jill Stein's Green Party, Green New Deal, Green Provisions, weather-changing, witchcraft, druid, pagan, magic?
Uh-oh. So you hit on a couple of different things for me there, not only environmentalism and Green Party. You hit a couple things. Speaking of druidism, one thing I like to tell Rex, I'm not Rex, Tex, is that weather is not climate. I'm just kidding, Rex. I'm just kidding, Tex. I just had to say it. No, but she did make a good quote. I'll give her that. Now, of course, personally, I'd like to see the Green Party move towards a more conservative leaning route, but that will take a lot of work, obviously, by the show that she put on tonight. She made some good points. I know one, I'm looking for a quote that she had tonight that I actually liked and wasn't really about anything with the environment.
Climate is harder to change than weather. So, you know, think about that when you go vote for changing that one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm against tectonic plates. I could fix that. Vote for me.
Yeah, she definitely, I hate to say, because, you know, a fellow, green environmentalist, you know.
Hold on. Robert, hold on a second before I let you do that, fellow green environmentalist. Let's be clear about a couple of things. Being for a clean environment and good principles of conservation does not make you a fellow with someone like Jill Stein, who A, thinks it's the most important issue, and B, whose solution to it is to, in fact, have more government. And if we know anything about climate and economy, free markets, like ours, for the most part in our past, has brought us a cleaner environment. And government-mandated economies like, communist China has brought us nothing but shitty pollution. And I think that Tex can give us firsthand knowledge of the wonderful aroma around Beijing.
Yeah, I would two things before I get into the China thing. I would just say, I'm all for, nature areas, conservation, that kind of stuff, natural parks and all that sort of thing. I just don't believe that you can have I don't believe that there is any government on planet Earth that can change the climate of the planet, okay? It's just that's not possible. You're electing the president of the United States, not Galactus, for God's sakes, okay? So nobody can do any of those things. So if you think that, I encourage you to time travel back to ancient Egypt where you can vote for your own pharaoh, and pharaoh apparently controls everything, And then you'll be very happy in that environment because you'll be building pyramids to Pharaoh's glory. But with regards to China, she said something stupid. China is a leader in clean energy.
What?
It's all coal.
Yeah.
It's all coal over there. It's all freaking coal.
Yeah,
also,
I don't know where she's getting her information. Yeah, I don't know where she's getting her.
More than 50% of the marginal demands of world oil is coming from China, okay? Oh, but it's all there. China's all green. China's completely green. I mean, is she nuts? Does she not know anything about how the freaking world works? Look, has she never heard of a Potemkin village?
Well,
because if you go to China, they have, oh, you know, we have this green, we have an energy plan, right? I'll get into why energy plans are a bad idea. But we have an energy plan, and look, it includes all this renewable and everything. Okay, that's great. It's a Potemkin village. It's bullshit, right? Because I've been over there. I took a bus. Look, let me tell you, I was sitting in a hotel in Beijing, right down the street from the Forbidden Palace, okay? And who's that basketball player who's like 29 feet tall, Yao Ming or something like that? What is his name? Does anybody know? I don't watch sports.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
he was standing
there. I don't know that either, so.
High school football, yeah, exactly, whatever. Anyway, so he actually happened to be in that hotel. He came walking through. It was kind of odd. But so I'm sitting in the hotel, drinking a coffee, and looking out across the street, and in Beijing they have these very, very wide streets. You always think China would be crowded. It's Japan that's very crowded. China's a big country, so they have a huge population, but it's spread out. So I'm looking across this really wide street, and it's like this morning mist, you know, and it's kind of blue, silvery, blue-gray, looking out across, you know, over this other building, and I'm like, oh, it's a nice morning. I check my watch, it's 1 o'clock in the freaking afternoon. I'm like, what? How does it look like this? And then you go out there, it's freaking smog. Like they used to talk about the London fog. That wasn't the London fog. It was the London smog because everybody's burning coal, right? So then we take a bus from Beijing down to Tianjin, which is their port city. That is about a 3.5-4 hour bus ride the entire way. Visibility is 100 feet because of this smog, right? And as my friend was saying, as we looked at this, I mean, literally, you're like, you live in the Blade Runner world. I mean, it's just the sky is leaden. It's oppressive, right? You can't see anything. My friend turned to me, he's like, have you seen a living animal anywhere out here? Do you even see a bird? I was like, no, I don't see anything. I don't see a lizard.
Wasn't there a concern during the last time the Olympics was held in China about the quality of air for the athletes?
Well, when I went over to the Great Wall, right, so you go to the Great Wall, you're kind of high up, and you can look out because part of the Great Wall comes really close to Beijing, an hour, hour and a half away. And if you look, they put these coal plants up in, they want them away from the city, but they put them up near, like, these little, what you would call a pass in the mountains. And so if you're up there, you look, you can see, oh, yeah, there's a coal plant there, and then all the smog is just straight over Beijing. So what they did for that is they shut the coal plants off. You know?
That's
and
what Obama
guess
did.
What? They controlled who didn't get electricity. Ah, you're poor. Screw you. For a week, you're going to go without electricity.
We're going to have all the media here for the Olympics.
I'll tell you something very interesting. When I was in my hotel in Beijing, and you're watching TV and you're flipping channels, right? You say, hey, it's CNN. What's going on, CNN? Right? Because you got CNN and you got BBC. Otherwise, it's all gibberish, right? So,
or Mandarin.
Yeah.
Same thing.
I would like to say a few positive words in your local gibberish. but, you know, so you're watching this stuff, and it's like, okay, and today in China, people, and then, boom, you get a black screen. It's like, what? All of a sudden, 30 seconds, and they come back, and now back to Paul. And you're like, what the heck happened there, you know? And then you realize that they've completely censored all this stuff. And, you know, you go down and you meet with your friends, and they're like, dude, I was watching the news, and just all of a sudden it was black for like a minute and a half. I'm like, yeah, they censored it.
Is that the same audio that they use? Is that the same audio they use at Bus Boys and Poets for the debate?
Yeah, that was
yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Crazy last night. That was frustrating. That was frustrating. My wife went and sat down and watched it with me. She's like, I can't take this anymore. She's like, I can't watch the debate anymore. I said, well, I don't have that luxury. I have to. But,
I know. Well, before, look, gentlemen, before we move off this topic, though, I would like to say that, you know, I think the simple answer here, and I mean, you know, we could go on and on about the environment, conservation, socialism, and all that stuff. But I think the simple fact is that what really makes for clean environments is private property, which is the cornerstone of a free market economy. Now,
exactly.
people argue, well, private property, but the corporations own it, and then they'll pollute the river. Well, let's understand something about the way river works. You might own a stretch of land adjacent to that river, but someone owns a stretch of land downstream. And if you start dumping crap into the river, it is going to fall onto their property, and now you are trespassing.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can involve the government in protecting property rights, unless you can negotiate something with your neighbor, like quit dumping shit in my river, let's figure something else out. So the fact is that free markets and private property clean the environment. They create an environment in which we will be aspiring to cleaner sources of energy that are more efficient, that don't pollute. And the fact is that we won't want to pollute, because if you're polluting, you're damaging your private property, and then you're screwing up the marketplace. Exactly, you're damaging profits.
Well, and
yeah,
it's also,
exactly. And look, just Robert, real quick, I just want to say something, because I want to get off the Jill Stein. Jill Stein's party, the Green Party, is a classic third party where it's a one-issue party. So that's why the entire night she's talking about climate change and a Green New Deal and all that kind of stuff, because they only have one issue. It's called the Green Party, for God's sake. So she doesn't have a policy on anything else. But Gary Johnson
was advancing
a full platform agenda. You know,
mm-hmm.
And so you have to realize Jill Stein was giving you a slice of a pie, right? A moldy, decrepit, tooth-decaying slice of poisonous pie, whereas, you know, Gary Johnson is bringing the full thing here. And, you know, I think he was right about, look, you want to get jobs back here? You want these companies to come back? Set a zero corporate tax rate. Set a 0% income tax rate on the American
mm-hmm.
people. Replace it with the sales tax. Boom, there you go. Okay, here comes all your jobs, right? You don't need, well, the government's going to go through, and then they're going to fund this company. Well, look, who's going to fund? They already did this. They gave the money to DOE, okay? And DOE, I mean, I know the people, they don't know who to fund. They have no freaking clue. They doubled the budget of the Department of Energy one year, and worse off, discretionary spending, right? I mean, under the Bush administration, they were killing our discretionary spending left and right, because Congress was like, you don't decide what to spend your money on. We decide for you. Under Obama, they're like, hey, here's $26 billion, whatever the hell it was, right? $26 billion. I mean, because the budget of the Department of Energy was like $24 billion when I left, and then, you know, they crept it up to whatever, $26, $28, and then they doubled it, right? Okay, so literally, you're talking about $25 billion that they had at their disposal, discretionary. They don't have business training. They don't know anything. You just gave a bunch of people. I mean, do you even know who works there? Some of these
accountants.
People? Yeah. They're not accountants. They're not business people. They're a bunch of, like, A freaking scientists who every kooky idea seems great because, hey, the potential is awesome, you know? Get them talking about colossal magneto resistance. Oh, shit, leave the room. No, I don't want to hear about your crazy, that is insane, that will never work. You know how much energy you need? Anyway.
But have they made progress on developing warp speed?
That's class.
On Star Trek, they have.
Oh, well, by the way, folks, we got, hold on, let me just introduce our other caller, because apparently feeding time is over. Trog is in the house.
I ate a baby elephant.
All right,
get in
Trog,
my belly.
I'm telling you.
Yeah, she's a nutcase. But she sounded good doing it. I saw Gary kind of nodding off there a couple times.
I nodded off a couple of times, Trog, but I have to echo what Tex said. What Tex said was 100% absolutely right, although I don't like the idea of classic third party. And frankly, I don't even like the term third party. Okay, let's start using the proper term. Alternate parties. Okay, these are alternates to the duopoly, alternate parties. So use the right terms. But I agree with what he said. He said that they are a one-issue party. Everything is environmental, which basically means that they put people last. Earth first,
did you hear
people
her,
last.
Did you hear her try to say she wasn't a one-issue party? Did you catch that, gobbledygook?
Yeah, it was a lame attempt. Because, look, the simple fact is, to the hammer salesman, the entire world is a nail. And to the Green Party, the entire world is an environmental problem. But I think the Green Party, and Dr. Jill Stein in particular, has a mental problem.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, her other issue that wasn't necessarily green one way or another The only thing I heard her say is, we need to bail out the students and make public higher education free. Okay, so the taxpayers need to bail out the students, so we need to pay for all the students' student loans. Like, full disclosure, I have a student loan, right? I'm not expecting you guys to pay for it, all right?
We already did.
You paid your salary at DOE.
Yes.
Exactly.
But then, make public higher education free. Okay, it's not free. It's not. Someone is paying for it. The professors are not showing up and like, hey, does anybody, are you going to give me beer nuts while I'm talking to you guys about this information? Because I'm not getting paid. I don't get any money for this. Could somebody bring me an apple or something? No, they get paid. Well, where does that money come from? It comes from you. You paid for it. We all paid for it. So why shouldn't the people using the service pay for it, right? Now, the problem is the government's subsidizing higher education. They're making it more expensive, and that essentially is the problem. And so her solution to too much government spending is that the government should spend even more. Pour gasoline on that fire. That'll put it out.
Yeah.
Well, I
now,
think one of the things...
Hold on. Let me take a little time out here because we've been bashing Jill Stein for like a half hour. For any of you liberal listeners, because there are a few, or for those of you who happen to have a liberal friend, I completely and 100% encourage you to vote for Jill Stein. Now, we're beating up on her a little bit because, well, let's face it, she's an easy target. But it's important to note that she is actually advocating liberal, not classical liberal, but modern liberal ideas, unlike the other fake liberal, Barack Obama. So if you happen to disagree with politics on the right side of the spectrum and you're voting for Obama out of fear that Romney wins, I would strongly suggest that you actually vote for your principles, which would be better expressed by Jill Stein or possibly Rocky Anderson. But I would take it one step further, and that's just for tomorrow. After that, I would like you to re-examine those liberal principles because they don't work. But at least vote for Jill Stein instead of Barack Obama. Continue with the Stein bashing.
Yeah, okay. Well, I would just say, look, I think the whole, you know, I want to talk about Gary Johnson, but it's like, you know, she was talking and just, like, infects you with, like, her stupidity. And it's like, how could anybody, I mean, she's Harvard educated, for God's sake. I mean, what is going on at that school?
So Barack Obama.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. She's, the argument she's making not through, you know, the power of her words or the how cogent her arguments were, but it's all through freaking emotion and all this kind of stuff. You know, which I just, I found to be a complete turnoff. Yeah, anyway, go ahead. I'd like to get it to Gary Johnson, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, let me just close the liberal conversation out. One of the things that I've heard often is, and the statistics are there, all these corporations have taken all this money overseas and they're hoarding it, and they talk about, you know, this big chunk of money that because corporations refuse to invest in this country, and that's the money they keep pointing at, saying that that's where our solution is at. I've heard that philosophy quite a few times. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there. I'm done.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'll give everybody one more comment, and of course we can bring Jill Stein back up again, but I would like to keep it in contrast to Gary Johnson and predominantly in order to take the greater debate of free markets versus command economies. But does anybody have one last comment they want to make about Jill Stein specifically before we move on to Gary Johnson?
Yeah, she did say one quote that I liked, and I put it in the chat over on Facebook. It says, if more of what is not working is what you want, vote for it. That's when they were talking about the free trade versus fair trade. And when they were having the debate about that, which I'm sure we'll cover more of tonight. Of course, she was on the fair trade side of it. But I thought that was an interesting quote because that didn't mainly go for what they were talking about specifically. But I think that was kind of a general comment of how a lot of people are voting just in general in this election, especially when it comes to Obama and Romney.
Yeah, and I would say I felt last kind of parting thoughts on Jill Stein. She hid behind slogans a lot, like, you know, too big to fail, too big to jail. And, you know,
like
what was the other one she kept repeating all the time? What was it? Well, she always says millionaires and billionaires, right? So that's a Democrat calling card. And, you know, she kept talking about out-of-control climate change. I mean, they're just, if you listen to that, listen to how often she repeats the exact same phrases. And I think that will show you that she's an inch wide and a centimeter deep, well, a millimeter deep. I mean, there's nothing there.
Tex, I think you're right, and I think it's simply because she's probably melancholy for the heyday of the hippie protests. And, of course, being a respectable doctor now, Harvard-educated with a career, she can't really kind of run out in the street and wave her sign wearing her tie-dye and her beads, haven't showered for 6 days. I mean, no one follows the dead anymore, do they? So I think that the issue is that that's what she's striving for, so she's trying to do it in a more respectable manner. And notice how she keeps always bringing up her arrest, which I think was unfair, because I think she had every right to be in the debate, but she brings it up.
She's such a rebel. Cred.
Exactly. She's trying to basically
She's
a hippie turned yuppie, and she's still got the old chops, and that's pretty much what she's running on. Now, as I beat up on her, because I think she's absolutely insane, I applaud the fact that she's running. I applaud the fact that people are giving her a platform, because you know what? America is about the free marketplace of ideas, and you have every right to put forward the stupidest ideas possible, because we know that in the marketplace they will fail. That's what competition is about. Good things succeed, bad things fail. When you distort competition, then crap succeeds and good things fail. So really, I think this is a good segue to talk about the difference between controlled economies and controlled political processes versus free markets and free political processes.
Well,
so,
and Rex, I'd like to tee it up this way for everyone on the phone, which is I have, you know, basically stated a few times, and Rex, you know, this is something that we say all the time, which is that the main political conflict in American society today is not between left versus right, it's between centralized power versus decentralized power. And if you look at what Jill Stein was saying, she clearly is on the side of the centralized power. She just wants it to have more of a green flavor. So she's there to influence the Democrat Party to drag it in more of a green direction. Whereas Gary Johnson, what I saw is he is for decentralized power and moving power away from Washington. And if you saw all of his answers, they related to that very question. And that, to me, was the ultimate thing to take away from that debate, that here you have somebody who's talking about decentralization of power, but really localization of power. It should come back to you, and it should come back to your community and your locality rather than everything becoming a federal issue. And Jill Stein, you know, she's building the fiery pits of Mordor or whatever to go make a, you know, something that's going to solve all the world's problems. We don't need that. There are no masterminds who know everything. We know what's going on in our communities and what's wrong with them and how to address the problems in our communities. And so I think Gary Johnson was advancing that very well. And I think a lot of his policies, particularly economic policies, were very good.
I have to agree with you, Tex. I think that, and that's, I think, the appeal that Gary Johnson has. And let me get my criticism of him out of the way first, so we can really get into the meat of this economic argument. I'm not a huge fan of the Libertarian Party because I think it's trying to be too many things, so it's somewhat incoherent. But if we can get them up to 5% in many areas and have easier ballot access, I think that that'll actually be very helpful to actually draw the Republicans towards more fiscal conservatism and sanity, because Libertarians are at least one thing, and that is fiscally conservative. Now, on other things, there are some issues, and I think that it's difficult in this country to put forward a political success that is trying to be fiscally conservative and yet missing the large base of this country who are moral Christian conservatives. But who knows? Maybe our complexion is changing and we'll suffer those consequences. But I think Gary Johnson is a mediocre, watered-down version of who Ron Paul is, or at least that's what he's trying to be. And frankly, I think that in any normal year of political discourse, he wouldn't be a factor. But as my co-host said on several of our past shows, in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And I think that puts Gary Johnson a leg up on just about everybody else because he's actually speaking true economic sense. And he may not be the most articulate or charismatic fellow. However, he is doing a incredible job if we line him up against Incohate, Rocky Anderson, Unicorn in Every Yard, Rainbow Over Every House, Jill Stein, and we put him up against, you know, corporatist Romney and corporatist Obama. I think that he would have a tougher time articulating these principles as commandingly if he was actually debating Virgil Goode, which is what I would like to see. Or definitely, I mean, Ron Paul would blow him out of the water. Of course, Gingrich would more or less hand him his ass on many things. But given the climate
Gingrich,
that we're
I mean,
in...
what are you going to do? Oh, God, I got to take Gingrich.
Yeah. Given the climate that we're in,
armor?
Though, even if you wear a suit of armor, Newt Zilla will melt right through it. But I think that the important thing to point out here, and this is important for everybody who's going to vote tomorrow, you're not voting for any of these candidates. Let's be clear about this. You're not voting for any of these candidates. First of all, if you're voting Romney because you're conservative, you know damn well you're not really voting for Mitt Romney. You're only going to vote for him because he's not Barack Obama. If you're a liberal, you're not voting for Barack Obama. You're only voting for Barack Obama because he's not Mitt Romney. If you're voting alternate party, rarely, you know that there's practically no chance your candidate is actually going to win. What you're voting for is the principles that that candidate and that party put forward. So if you're voting Obama-Romney, you're essentially voting for the same principles. You're voting for more oligarchy, more corporatism, more Keynesianism, more duopoly, more police state, more undeclared wars, more Federal Reserve, more debt, more deficit, more destruction. If you're voting alternate parties, you are voting for those parties to have standing and ballot access. If you're a conservative and you're in a state that accepts write-ins, you got your option of Ron Paul. If you're in the 47 states, I think, where you have the Constitution Party on there, you got Virgil Goode. If you're a conservative who thinks that at this stage of the game we have a larger economic problem than we have a moral problem, now I'm not saying I agree with that position, but if that's what you think, then you absolutely 100% can vote for Gary Johnson because on economics he's certainly better than the others. So that's what you're voting for. You're voting in order to break the duopoly. So when we're talking about Johnson today, I want to talk about the policies he put forward. And I have to say that for the most part, he articulated a very sensical approach in his text. As you said, he was talking about diffusion of power and free markets. And I think that's very important. So I'd like to kind of go down that track, free markets and the diffusion of power. Thoughts?
Well,
yeah, I totally agree.
And look, one of the most important things, I think, in that path, and Charlie, I'll turn it over to you in just a sec. But one of the most important things is eliminate the IRS. You know, for God's sake, how much is this organization into your life, right? Because if someone gives you money, you have to count that as income, right? I mean, so like if your parents give you money, you know, or if your friend gives you money, that counts as income. You have to count it. Now, it's discountable up to a certain amount, right? But they still, that's counted in gross revenues. They want to know all the money you received, every single dollar you ever received, right? And then you discount from there. Well, how much of an intrusion is that into your life, right? I mean, your economic life is your ability to survive. And the government is all over it. So, you know, I think, you know, one of the first things that you can do to restore, you know, liberty in the country is get rid of the IRS, go to a sales tax, you buy something. Okay, you pay the tax. That's fine. You know, I don't have a problem with that because it's not intrusive. You know,
and tax. Guess what? The Constitution doesn't have a problem with that either. The Constitution absolutely does not prohibit the general government, if your representatives feel it's adequate, from putting in a sales tax, provided that it does not favor any person, company, industry that is fair and equal across the board. There is no prohibition in the Constitution for that. There is, however, a prohibition in the Constitution for a direct income tax. And the 16th Amendment doesn't really change that. So what Gary Johnson is talking about, some people start figuring, oh, if we don't have an income tax, how are we going to fund the government? And we won't have roads and schools, and our military will be defunded. No. I mean, we operated until 1913 without such a mess. Why don't we go back to that? Chris?
Yeah, I mean, we did fine. Actually, we were doing really good before we had the income tax. I mean, remember how fast America was growing, how much the economy was doing well, everybody's standard of living was going up, up, and up, and then we got an income tax, and then it's just kind of been, like, downhill since then. So, I don't know, except apart for the part where we blew up all the other manufacturing in the world. That actually worked out really good.
By destroying your
competition, you're going to make a lot of money on that.
That was, successful war, an illegal one.
Yeah. Let's destroy all our competitors so that our inefficient, high-taxed economy will succeed. That's a great strategy.
We've never bombed like that.
That's the only way to make socialism work, is you have to blow up the competition, because now everybody's got to buy your product.
But, Tex, you know damn well that, as Margaret Thatcher told us, once you blow up everybody's stuff, then there won't be any more stuff to blow up, and then socialism will fail.
Yeah. It inevitably fails, because it's not based on anything, and that, to bring it to a Jill Stein point, it's my whole problem with the Green New Deal. It's a fake industry that doesn't exist to create a product that nobody wants.
Well, one thing that could be considered green if it comes to, you know, consumption tax or sales tax, is one argument for that is for those who want to conserve or to use less, as a lot of conservationists use the term they use, is actually a sales tax or consumption tax actually benefits folks who want to conserve, because the only time you're actually paying those taxes is when you're buying something. Well, if you are doing barter, as something Virgil Good has talked about, or you are just hanging on to whatever goods that you have and not always, buying things, you know, that are new or something or things of that nature, or if you're conserving, then you're not paying as much taxes. So it's kind of, at least for environmentalists, would be, you know, even a better plan for those who would consider themselves as such, or in a liberal stance. I think liberals can, be happy with a consumption tax or sales tax as well, because the folks who will, I mean, if they're talking about the rich paying their fair share, the rich will still be spent, you know, paying more in taxes, because it'll be the rich who will be paying, who will be buying more of the more expensive stuff, thus more tax money coming from them. So I think that would be what they would consider a fair tax, would be a consumption or a sales tax.
Correct. Robert, there are two problems. One, right now the government is passing laws in order to make barter, exchange, transactions, and things of that nature reportable in order to make them taxable. And if you haven't looked into it, you really need to look into the Office of Consumer Financial Protection housed inside the private Federal Reserve Bank. They are monitoring every single transaction made, and they're trying to get it up so that they can actually make a profile of you quite easily based on your spending. Of course, this is done ostensibly for your protection to keep you safe from fraud and stuff, but they're monitoring everything. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is, in order to change the tax system, we have to look to the Constitution, and we have to do it in a manner where it is done very, very carefully, because most of the time when someone proposes a flat tax, a fair tax, a sales tax, a 999 tax, or whatever else, they talk about this transition period as we phase out the IRS, which means you will actually have two systems in place, and what you will actually end up with is the government will then, after the next election, will reverse their position and will actually keep both taxes.
And you'll just get rid of the IRS while you have a sales tax. I'm
not saying it can't be done. I'm saying we, the people, have to be very vigilant about how it's done, because they'll give us what we want, another tax that's actually a better tax, but then they'll also retain the one that they have, and we'll end up with both.
That's why the 999 was
throw this out there for you guys to consider, okay? The federal budget, all right, for 2011, well, they voted on 2011 for 2012, it's $3.8 trillion.
Jeez, my
God. Do you know how much money that is? What are they spending this money on? Where is all of this stuff going? You know, so they talk about, we're going to cut waste, fraud, and abuse. Okay, hopefully there's $2.8 trillion worth of waste, fraud, and abuse, because you're spending like $4 trillion too freaking much. You know, I mean, this is a major problem. Where's this money going? Everybody's, well, it's going to pay for the military and all this kind of stuff.
No,
it's not going for the military. It's going for all these sort of, you know, transfer payments to other people, right? And, you know, look,
other countries.
Consider this. If you're a working person, right, and you have a job and, you know, you are getting a start out in life, okay? So say you even try to go to college and then for whatever reason you wash out. Various things happen in your life that just make it difficult for you. But you got a job waiting tables, right? Something like that. And so you decide, well, I make good money on tips. I have a pretty good life. I go out. I have a lot of fun. And, you know, I never really wanted to write Beethoven's Fifth to begin with. So I'm doing okay. So this is all that I want to worry about, right? So you go, you know, live this lifestyle. And then, you know, the government comes. I'm sorry. I am actually having that stabbing pain again.
All right.
But anyway, so you, you know, you're making a small amount of money, okay, and you're kind of living this lifestyle and everything, but the government is coming back and it's taking more and more from you, and so it's eroding that, you know, your earnings, and the government spending keeps going up and up and up. Now, as you are making this limited amount of spending or limited amount of income, the question that you have is, at a certain level, going on welfare pays a certain amount, right? So there's some sort of minimum level at which, hey, I could stay at home and not work at all and collect welfare, right, or government rents, right? And so if you continue to increase the size of government rents, what you're doing is this person who's on the margin now has to make a decision as to whether or not it makes sense for them to actually show up for a job, have somebody yell at them or whatever, you know, happens at their work or customers are upset with them, or I could stay at home and do nothing. So it becomes about, you know, I am making $300 more a month working than I would if I just sat at home and did nothing. And then they have to ask themselves the question, is it worth it to sit home? And eventually, if you keep raising the size of the payments, it makes this a difficult choice, and you keep drowning out more and more people and thus putting more and more people on the dole and putting more and more working people on the hook for more expenses.
Yep, and Tex, actually, your example was great, and I mean, I think it drove the point home, but let's take it a step further, because this also applies to educated professionals. In fact, the median salary, at least as of 4 years ago, for an engineer in these United States was about $60,000 a year national. Obviously, in certain metro areas, it's six figures or higher, but $60,000 was the national average. When the economy really got rocked and a lot of these engineers got laid off, especially the ones who were not as either were close to retirement or were just starting out, they got laid off. Some of these engineers realized, hey, you know what? I lost my salary, but I'm getting, you know, a percentage of it in unemployment payments that were funded by my employer when I was working, and they took that money out of, you know, my check. Even though it didn't directly come out of the check, the federal unemployment taxes and the state unemployment taxes are an expense to your employer. It's part of the payroll expense for hiring you, so it is money that they don't have because they hire you, which means that it's your cost. And then you're getting these checks, which are a percentage of your income, and now you're getting them for, you know, I don't know, 99 weeks or whatever the extension was. And then you realize, hey, now I'm saving $20,000 a year because I don't have to put my kid in daycare. And I can stay home and actually raise my kids, and I can play Xbox, and I can have a leisurely time. I don't have my deadlines and all this kind of stuff. And with the savings that I'm getting in not having to buy my lunch and not travel to work, and, you know, my spouse and my taxes, and my spouse has a job, we're actually doing okay. We're doing okay, and I actually have a better lifestyle because my kids know me better than when I'm commuting 2 hours a day and spending eight to 10 hours a day at work, plus travel. So, you know, this isn't that bad a deal. So what the government has ostensibly done is not solve the problem of people being laid off because of an economic shift or a distortion that they actually caused, but they've actually incentivized people to not go back to work.
That's right.
And then the economy picks up, those companies have to rehire these people, and it bids up the price, because the guy that was asking for 60 before is now going to be asking you for 80, because he's like, well, if you're going to, you know, make me come back to work and change my lifestyle and everything, it better be something a little bit more in it for me. And, of course, in those 4 years that he was unemployed, inflation has eaten away at the dollar so much, so he's actually not asking you for 80, he's asking you for 100, and we've just created a 40% increase in the cost of engineering in this country, and that travels and translates into every product that you buy from these companies that have to hire these engineers. So it's a disaster, and that's what happens when the price signal is distorted. Okay, the price is set by the marketplace, that tug and pull between the low price the buyer wants to pay and the high price the seller wants to charge is what sets the price at the market. And then
plus
that is an efficient signal. It's an efficient signal as to what we need more of and what we shouldn't be making. So, you know, when car prices come down, people buy cars, and the horse and buggy business gets bid up and becomes a luxury for Central Park and weddings. So that's how the price signal works. When the government jumps in there and starts distorting these signals by artificially keeping interest rates low or creating a false demand in student loans or giving easy loans for houses people can't afford, is it screws up that price signal and it causes the boom and then the ensuing bust, and then we all get swept up in that process. And, of course, the real big players who took excessive risks because of the moral hazard, well, they're too big to fail, so they privatize all of the profits, and then they socialize the losses and end up bailing them out. And that's exactly why there's a problem with the way things work. And if you really look at it, right now there's a great example of this, and I actually think Gary Johnson touched on this, and he did a very good job of it in the debate.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Hurricane Sandy, where we've got gas lines, gas shortages, water not getting in place, all because of FEMA. And if you... You know, and the rules against, quote, price gouging. What the hell do they mean by price gouging? I mean, the simple fact is that if you're selling water for 99 cents a bottle and people are buying it all day long from your convenience store, right, and then this hurricane's coming and you're not getting your shipment, and you're getting a shipment every 72 hours or your cupboard will be bare. You won't have any stock on your shelves to sell people, which is a terrible thing. The issue of inventory for a retailer, it's one, you don't want it to sit stagnant, because if your inventory doesn't turn over, your operating expenses start eating away at your adding to your cost of goods and eat away at your profits. If, however, you're selling too rapidly and can't replenish your inventory, then you have the other problem that you're losing customers, because when they come to buy something, it's not there, and then they'll say, okay, I'm not coming back to see this guy ever again. Exactly. So hold on, let me finish the point, and then I'll let you go, Robert. So the idea of price gouging is that, well, you know, maybe if I wasn't selling these bottles at 99 cents a piece, I could sell them at $2.50 a piece. Oh, he's taking advantage of people in a bad situation. Actually, he's slowing down that turnover or increasing his profitability so that maybe he can incentivize the truck drivers to take the risk of driving through the dangerous area and the suppliers to churn out products at a faster rate to get them to where they need to be. Because clearly the demand in the Northeast for bottled water is far greater now than it is in the Southwest. And therefore, if you want to shift the goods, you need to price them up so that people know, hey, that's where we need to go for the profit. That's where the product needs to be. The government, on the other hand, distorts that signal, and you end up with shortages. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, I was just going to make a little observation that, you know, there was this massive hurricane with Sandy, and there's a lot of talk about it. But normally, when there's a hurricane, gas prices shoot through the roof. Did anyone else notice that really didn't happen this time? At least not where I live, it hasn't. I mean, an election being around the corner might have something to do with it, but I've noticed every year when there's an election, gas prices go down. And what I find fascinating is that usually, as I said, when there's a hurricane, gas prices shoot up. But this time, it did not, at least not where I'm from. So, I don't know, I just find that kind of peculiar that, you know, that didn't happen.
Where are you from?
This time around with the gas price. Oh, Ohio. Gas prices didn't shoot up here after the hurricane. No, normally they do. normally the gas prices shoot up after hurricanes.
They will, right after the election.
Yeah, but...
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's my point.
Don't get carried away. You people gave us Boehner. I'm just busting your balls, Robert.
Well, I mean, one thing, Robert, I mean, you're in Cleveland, right? So you're on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains from the East Coast. You're in a completely different pad, right? Or you're in a completely different refining area. So they created these things back in World War II, and it was a way to administer the refining of petroleum, which the Army needed. So they're petroleum administrative defense districts, or PADs, right? Okay, so PAD 1 is the East Coast, PAD 2 is, you know, sort of the Midwest, Illinois, you guys, and then PAD 3 is the Gulf Coast down here in Texas, where most of the refining capacity is. But PAD 1, prices are going up, but you're on the other side of the Atlantic, so, you know, you're essentially doing okay because you're in a different area. That's all I would add to that. I don't know. It's probably a wonkish point. Sorry about that.
No, that was a good point. No, I mean, that's a good point, because it shows you how industry has already taken care of the problems that arise from distribution based on geography, locality, demand, custom, access. Industry solves these problems. It's government that professes to solve these problems, but actually creates barriers to the delivery of goods. Now, people say, well, but why would the government do that? Isn't the government good? Well, the government is supposed to do good if it's doing the will of the people, with certain checks and balances in order to also not go full on towards just the passions of the people, because the people as a mob can be fickle. And that's why we have a Republican form of government, small r Republican. However, what happens when the corporatists, transnational bankers, very wealthy, it's not even the 1%, it's like the 0.00001% who own multiple corporations through interlocking directorates, when they realize that they can buy politicians and buy elections, then they get these laws put in place by forcing these guys to accept their fundraising and making elections more and more expensive, so that these guys have to spend 50% of their time just raising money, and that comes with strings. Then they develop laws in order to manage that distribution so that competitors can't access the market and it's actually easier for them. It's weird, because sometimes people go, like, why would Philip Morris, be in favor of these fines for all the tobacco costs? It cost them billions of dollars. Yes, but the thing is that Philip Morris can afford the billions of dollars, but all of your small, local tobacco manufacturers, especially those who make tobacco products that don't have glue and additives and tar and carcinogens, just regular tobacco, which is not nearly as dangerous. In fact, the jury's kind of out on whether it's actually bad for your health. It's mostly the carcinogens that they put in the artificial tobacco products that kill you, like the ones Philip Morris makes. You push all those smaller manufacturers out because they can't handle that extra cost, but Philip Morris can. And then what happens is Philip Morris can pick up their assets for pennies on the dollar when they either go bankrupt or are forced to sell, and you end up with less competition in the marketplace.
And thus we have found the necessary reason for government, which is to eliminate your competitors.
Exactly. And if you really think about it, the regressive income tax that we have, okay, is designed specifically for that person, for that purpose, okay? When you think about it, first of all, the payroll taxes are very, very regressive, the so-called FICA contributions, like Social Security and Medicare. Those hammer the poorest people hardest. And then the other tax, the graduated income tax, actually harms, quote, the wealthy, except that there are so many ways to get around that the ultra-wealthy can get away with it, but it's those in the middle, as opposed to the working class or the capitalist class, the investor class. You have the entrepreneur, the merchant class, or what we call the middle class. They're the ones who get squeezed and pushed out of the way, because those are the competitors for the large corporations, and that's what they don't want. Wall Street hates Main Street and wants Main Street gone. And so the way they do that is, if you look at it, who was most in favor of this ridiculous income tax in 1913? It was the same pricks that brought us the 17th Amendment eliminating states' representation in the federal government. It was the same pricks that brought us the Federal Reserve, which they had a secret meeting at Jekyll Island, Georgia, November 22, 1910, and concocted this banking cartel. And they're the same ones that gave us this tax. Well, wait a minute, Rex. Are you trying to tell me that the wealthy guys like Vanderbilt and Rockefeller and Morgan and Warburg and Kuhn and Loeb, that these guys actually wanted to be taxed? Yes, because those guys already made their fortunes when there was no income tax. And by putting the income tax in place, they made it hard for anybody who's aspiring to become wealthy to catch up to them. When you start understanding
to something we were talking about earlier tonight, Rex, which is the enemy of the left is the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the left, the whole language of the left, if you listen to it, goes about the working man has got to, you know, stand up to these millionaires and billionaires, right? That is code for capitalists, right? Back in the working man versus the capitalist, right? So the captains of industry versus the iron lunch pail guy, all that stuff is code for union labor versus the, you know, the robber barons, the Vanderbilts and the J.P. Morgans and all this kind of stuff, right? So for them, the entire economy is a 1920s economy. The U.S. economy has not changed since the 1920s. Everybody's going, they're building skyscrapers, you know, they're carrying iron lunch pails. Who has an iron lunch pail? I never met this guy, right? Carrying iron lunch pails to work, and they're welding stuff, right? That's what everybody's doing. That's the majority of economic activity. And then above them is this big capitalist with his hands on his hips, arms akimbo, and just laughing and giggling, probably wearing a monocle or something. This is how the left views the economy. But what's not in the equation is the middle class, because the middle class for the left is the enemy. And the reason is that the middle class, of course, has a modicum of wealth, and so therefore they are not, you know, living hand-to-mouth or paycheck to paycheck. And they aspire to be wealthy themselves someday. They don't necessarily want to be a captain of industry, but they would like to be well-to-do or have some nice things or, you know, whatever it is, some degree of privacy or some peace and quiet or, you know, who, God only knows what motivates people to do things, right? But that's what they want. And then, in the eyes of the left, these people are not part of the class struggle of the iron lunch pail guys versus the big capitalists. And so these people are viewed as voting against their own interests because they will never become rich. They will never be the captain of industry. Well, who? Not everybody wants to be a captain of industry. Some people just want to do okay, right? Like, I'm doing okay. You know, that's all I want. I don't want to fucking run the world. I mean, that's kind of a headache, right? Ask Barack Obama how it's what it's like to run a global empire. It's not exactly freaking easy, right? But they're viewed as class enemies now because they identify with the wealthy. And they're like, well, you know, don't disadvantage this person because you're disadvantaging me and my ability to, you know, get wealthy and that type of thing. So I've acquired behaviors that have made me wealthy. And this gets back to what was the middle class called in France? The bourgeoisie, right? And the communists and the socialists, they hate the bourgeois. They hate the middle class. And the bourgeois have to be gotten rid of because they're the class enemy. What they want is the tiny, small number of industrialists and capitalists who, I mean, how many people are Bill Gates's in the world? Like, very few, right? Versus the masses, right? They always talk about the masses. And so they want this Nietzschean struggle of the many against the few. And the middle class clouds the picture. And so they want the middle class out of the picture. And that's why all their economic policies are really designed to destroy the middle class, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Yep, and you're absolutely right, Tex. And this is what people have to start understanding. And we talked about this actually in our first show. We talked about that the true left-right paradigm, if you're going to look at it that way, is on the extreme left, you have absolute government. And it doesn't matter what it is. It could be democracy. It could be monarchy. It could be a secular dictatorship. It could be even a republic. It doesn't matter, but absolute government. On the other extreme, the right, you have anarchy, the absence of government totally. Neither option works, which is why our founding fathers put us smack dab in the middle with a nod towards the right, which is anarchy. So it's about diffusion of power as opposed to concentration of power. That environment engenders a middle class because it gives the average person the ability to aspire to the next level by becoming a merchant, a business owner, or something of that nature. And that middle class tends to grow in free markets. And it benefits everybody because those who can't be the entrepreneurial class, those who manage the businesses, will either be the capitalist class, who are the ones who finance these things legitimately, okay, or you will be the working class, which means that maybe you don't have the management skills or even the desire. Maybe you want a simple life and you don't want the headache of running a business to be employed by these entrepreneurs. And it actually raises those people up because unskilled labor can be quite remunerative in a free market economy where we have a manufacturing base and entrepreneurs are building these factories and providing these goods for the consumer. So the idea is that it actually raises everybody to have a burgeoning middle class. But the uber upper class hate that. They hate that,
absolutely,
and they always want to do away with it.
Well, you know, and this comes down to, look, you know, people are different, all right? So not everybody wants the same thing out of life. One guy, more than anything else, who wants to be a captain of industry, right, and be viewed by his peers, like, look at how powerful I am, how much I've amassed, right? And the guy next to him's like, I would never want to deal with his negative press, you know? But I help the guy out because I like being well-to-do and everything, but, you know, I don't want to deal with his problems. So I found a way to be the next guy in line, right? But I'm behind the scenes, and I kind of like that, right? And then there are other people who are like, I don't want to deal with the right hand to the throne problems where I know where all the bodies are buried and I have to give all the good advice and everything. You know, I want to come in and do this at the board meeting, right? And that's just my function. I'm not trying to showboat or anything like that. I just do my thing. You know, and then there's another guy down there that's like, look, I just want to wait tables. You know why? I find a lot of responsibility. You just got to tell a few jokes, make sure the people at the table like what's going on, then you feel good, they feel good, everyone's having a good time, I feel good about myself, then I can go home and do whatever the hell I want, right? Everyone wants something different out of life. But the problem with the left is everyone has to want what they want out of life. You have to want to control the means of production. I mean, who has the time? For God's sakes, it's a busy day, man. Now I got to worry about this. You know, and so I saw something recently. There was somebody on a news program, whatever, the video I saw, and they were talking about how too many women, they are willing to accept the patriarchy in exchange for, you know, whatever, right? So what they're saying is there's still some women in America who are, you know, willing to listen to what their husbands say or, you know, whatever. Look, not everyone... not every husband wants to run the household, okay? Some do, some don't. Not every woman wants to run the household. Some do, some don't. Why does everybody have to fit in the same box? It's the same thing. Look, everyone's different, and everyone's getting something different out of life.
No,
socialists
because it's
are like,
easier
no,
to manage.
This is the life program, and you have to be completely signed on to my life program, and this is what you get out of life, and this is what you have to want. Otherwise, you're a class enemy or something. I mean, it's just...
Well, Aldous Huxley talked about this very thing, Tex. In his Brave New World, you know, there were alphas, betas. You know, you were basically, by genetic engineering or by disposition or by, you know, school testing, it was determined what you were qualified to be, and that's what you get to do, and you don't get to change. And, in fact, in Europe, they instituted this kind of system in their educational process where you take certain tests at periods of your... primary and secondary education, they tell you what majors you may aspire to in higher education. So they kind of funnel you towards particular careers. And it's designed because the fundamental thing that people have to understand is economics is not about money. Economics is not even so much about the distribution of capital. Economics is about people. And we have to remember that the economy is designed to serve man, not man the economy. In the socialist structure, which Jill Stein was promoting all night tonight, okay, the man, you, the individual person, when I say man, I mean men and women, and in some cases even children too, you are designed to serve the economy. In the free market version, which they always tell us, greedy capitalists, all about money, in the true free market capitalist system, it is about capital being moved by those who have an understanding of how to move it for the benefit of people, and the economy serves man. And the truly successful free market entrepreneur in a true free market capitalist system is the one who finds the way to most efficiently, at the lowest price and the lowest cost, to serve the most people. And that's the beauty of it. And that's
absolutely
what they're trying to get rid of.
I think I cut Trog off earlier, and I'm not sure if I threw it back to him. Trog, are you still there?
I don't remember what I was talking about. What were we talking
about?
Talk about
something else.
Sorry about that.
Well, no, it's all right. Well, I was reading a whole series of desperate, psychotic liberals and Republicans underneath a video that they're trying to get out really fast to show that this will destroy Romney or Obama or whatever, whichever one guy it is, you know. And I was just reading the statements, and I was just like, people are nuts, man, absolutely nuts. But anyway, Gary Johnson, he has some fairly good economic points. The thing that I find very few people talk about, and it's good to hear, including the liberal, communist, socialist, Green Party, and Rocky, is the trade deals.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never hear that stuff talked about. People don't understand that so much of the industry, what gives these companies the ability to move offshore and leave our country in the mess it's in over the last 20, 30 years, is these damn trade deals.
Mm-hmm.
And the third-party people are the only people who have talked about this. And I actually, when we interviewed Good, I had a chance to kind of drill in on that a little bit deeper with him, and I wish I would have had more time to really get into it, because he's been there, you know, on those votes, in those packages. And I would love to expose the truth on this, because it's killing our country. It's
Chris,
the doorway for these countries.
Chris, one interesting thing about Chris, one interesting thing about what you just said, that he was there. Good voted against NAFTA, CAFTA, WTO, and all that
everything.
Stuff. And as much as it pains me to say this, unfortunately, that puts him more towards the free market and more towards the right than another guy who was in Congress with him at the time who voted for those things, and that happens to be Newt Gingrich. That's one of the areas where I disagree with Newt. Now, it's a pretty big area, but obviously without all the other good stuff Newt did, I was willing to overlook that. And that just reminds everybody, don't look for a perfect candidate. There isn't one. You will always have problems, and they will all make mistakes. But you find the one who you agree with the most. And for me, in this race, it was Newt Gingrich and then Ron Paul. Now, here's the interesting thing. And Good actually makes this mistake sometimes, because Washington speak is free trade deals. So he says, I'm against free trade. Well, that's not true.
Right.
He's not against free trade. What he's against, and what is a misnomer, because in an Orwellian newspeak manner, this is how Washington twists and manages your perceptions, what they call free trade, like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is actually managed trade.
Yep.
It is simply
right.
more corporatism, because free trade does not require a 3,000-page agreement with annotations and footnotes and departments to manage it. Free trade is pretty much, hey, we'll sell you our shit, you sell us your shit, but we have these standards for access to our economy, and this is the price of entry. And
I
that's
used
how
to
it's
write
done.
Agreements, international agreements for the U.S. government. I could get that thing down to a page, page and a half tops, if you want.
Yeah.
You want a tight agreement, I could write that one for you.
Didn't Reagan tell all of his advisors, if you can't bring me a proposal or your idea on one page, don't bring it? No, it's because Reagan
exactly.
is stupid. Because Reagan's so dumb. Actually, he's not. That's genius. And if you actually look throughout history, and actually Da Vinci said it very succinctly, he said simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And the free market doesn't get more simple. And everybody says, oh, no, the free market, you got all these different people doing all these different things. It's completely uncoordinated and random. Well, Adam Smith called that the invisible hand. It does seem random, but when you have free actors in an economy doing what they think is best by trial and error, which is the profit motive, either you will succeed or you will fail. You will either garner more money or you will lose competitive market advantage by doing either the right thing or the wrong thing, and you'll do less of the wrong thing and more of the right thing. So it's actually the idea of not controlling it creates the most efficient and simple system and manages the complexity of the market more efficiently than any one person doing any kind of socialist command control economy calculus can. And that's the vision. That's the vision that if the Republicans actually wanted to be conservative and wanted to win, they would run that vision against the Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, quote, Democrat vision of a command and control economy. But the problem is the Republicans and the Democrats are both vying for the command and control economy. And only Gary Johnson, Virgil Goode, and Ron Paul are advocating for the other. But
you know what's stupid about this whole thing? I'm sorry. Let me just throw this out here. I've been in business for myself my whole life. The numbers and the analytical processes and the research that I do and the consultants that I sit down with and the tax and the, you know, my lawyer, every move I make is extremely detailed and drawn out and run against multiple scenarios, because if I screw up, I lose everything. The government is not as efficient as I am as one entrepreneur on the market. No way, because they don't lose shit when they screw it up, because they keep their damn jobs and they can go out and steal more money off of people on their bad deals. I don't. I have to go out, lose my ass, you know, start over, pay off all the bills from the last bad deal to do it again. I cannot fathom how they have sold the idea that free enterprise, that we're less efficient, less knowledgeable, or less sophisticated, or less moral. I have to be extremely moral in every decision I make, because I'm dealing directly with customers who can screw me and not pay me and put me in court.
That's the thing about people who have not worked for the government. If you work for the government, you're there. You see how it works. There's no sense of how much things cost. There's no sense of,
accountability? How about accountability?
You just start talking about, you know, $1,000, that's the K. So you start talking about Ks, and then if you need a million, you start talking about megabucks. We need 10 megabucks for this thing. Oh, it's just 10 megabucks or whatever. I mean, literally, they're just throwing this stuff around all over the bureaucracy. And, you know, they're pulling this stuff together. It's like, oh, well, I guess that didn't work out. Well, whatever, you know, we tried. But there's no, you know what I'm saying? There's no penalty. There's no payment. There's no, nobody has to tighten their belt. They're like, man, we need to, okay, nobody has mechanical pencils anymore. We're going back to, you know, wooden pencils. And, you know, we're going to get rid of these computers. We're going to go to the abacus or something. You know, I mean, there's no buckling down. And you know what?
Yep.
This is the worst thing. A lot of people don't realize this. The government rewards failure. Because if a program fails, you know why it failed?
Not enough money.
Didn't have enough money.
That's right.
So they throw money at it. Hey, this guy completely failed. This whole program is a complete disaster. Let's fund the hell out of it. That's exactly what government does. And if it's successful, they're like, look, we gave this guy all this money, and he was able to produce the results that we wanted with fewer people than we thought that he was going to need. And so let's cut his budget. That's how government works. Every incentive is wrong.
Yep, and Tex, just so that we're clear, because I agree with you 100%, and that was, I couldn't have articulated that better. Corporations, the large corporations, the ones that don't operate on the owner's initiative, but the ones that are now running by banksters and transnational financiers. Look at Disney. When Walt Disney was running, it was one company. Look at it now. It is an NWO transnational cog. Okay, it is a machine for them.
Hey, they just bought Lucas
they do the
and
same thing.
Release Star Wars 7, by the way.
Yeah, it's going to be awful. They do the same thing, which is why, if you notice, in these large companies, people tend to fail upwards. And if you notice, anybody who's in upper management or in the corporate office, these are the people that have never either been on the production line or they've never been in the sales field force, and they fail upwards with their MBA. And they end up managing people who actually make stuff and people who actually sell stuff when they don't know how to make anything and they don't know how to sell anything. And rather than promoting from your sales force and your manufacturing force, you promote from outside, or they fail upwards because they can politic better or they earn their job on the couch or what have you. Then you end up with these incompetent managers in corporations who are running people who actually do the work into the ground. That's the problem.
It's the same problem. That
mentality in the corporation, then it's going to use the government to further that mentality. And, of course, the government is set up on that model exactly. So you end up with all of these people who are kingdom builders. And what they do is they secure for themselves a position of power so that they could build a little kingdom, and they manage all these people when they don't know what the hell they're doing. You know, sort of like that old cliche where it says, if you don't know how to do, teach. Well, if you don't know how to produce, manage. And so that's what we end up with. We end up with a company, with a country and an economy run by managerial bureaucrats as opposed to actual entrepreneurs who funnel the capital from the capitalist to its highest and best use, utilizing the labor of those who want to be either salespeople or production line or any kind of actual work that needs to be done, the real frontline work. And that's how everybody benefits everybody else. The capitalists benefit from their investments. The entrepreneurs benefit by funneling the capital towards where it needs to be and providing benefits to people and hiring workers. And it's a symbiotic system. As soon as you introduce bureaucratic managerial interference, you screw it up. And Newt Gingrich talked about this so well. He articulated it so succinctly that if we'd run the vision that Newt Gingrich was espousing against this crap that Obama's been feeding us, we would have already won this election because he talked about bureaucratic socialism and the managed decay. And Romney is the same prick as Obama who wants to manage this decay through bureaucratic socialism as opposed to production, sales, and benefit. And that's why we are where we are.
Romney is nothing. I relate to him as a free enterpriser in no way at all. All he does is gather money from people, and sometimes pretty nasty people, buy shit up, load it with debt, charge huge management fees, sell it off without any concept for the future. He gets lucky a couple times so he can tout those figures, you know, oh, yeah, we made, you know, all these jobs, you know, and don't look over here, though, you know, because we rape these companies. And he's that whole structure. I think I lost my, $1 million on because of bastards like, excuse my French, bastards like him back in the dot-bomb era. You know,
I remember those guys.
They don't build crap, and he is not. You know, I don't know how anybody thinks, and maybe because they don't think. You know what I'm saying? But how anybody thinks his business model will save this country, because he'll leverage this country right into China, Iran, South America. Anybody who'll cut a deal with him, he's going to carry that whole broken system down.
Rick Perry got it right. He called him a vulture capitalist. And you can only be a vulture capitalist. The only way you can be a hyena or a vulture capitalist is when you have the power of government's guns at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the true free marketplace, you run around like that, yeah, you might succeed once or twice. But people are going to catch on to you, and you're going to get booted out of that market because people don't put up with that kind of bullshit in the free market. But when you have the government available to you and you can ingratiate yourself, now you've got all those levers. That's Romney's model.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Romney
mm-hmm.
thinks. Romney doesn't think like you. So when people hear him say the things that he's been told to say because Frank Luntz tested it and that's how he's, you know, I relate to that. You know, look at the motivation behind the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. It's almost like flip sides of the same coin. The Tea Party initially rose up. Who was the Tea Party? The Tea Party were retired people or people approaching retirement who had a nest egg to protect and people who owned businesses. Unfortunately, most of the working stiffs couldn't participate in the Tea Party because guess what? They barely have time to raise their kids, commute to work, and earn. But those who were in retirement or those who ran businesses had more flexible schedules, and that's what made up that Tea Party. And it was, hey, wait a minute, you're screwing with my business or you're screwing with my nest egg. Occupy Wall Street, on the other hand, are the younger people for the most part, and some leftover hippies, but mostly the younger people who are like, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to have a
nest egg,
and I can't get a business. So the angst came from the same thing, which is too much corporatism. Unfortunately, because of the lack of education, when I say education, I'm not talking about our government-run system. I'm talking about true knowledge and education and understanding about basic economics, which is not that complicated, and it is the duty of every single person in a free market to understand to some degree. Because of that lack of education, they were indoctrinated into Marxism, thinking that, you know, the vision that Jill Stein painted today of a unicorn in every yard and a rainbow over every house is attractive. But it's a fantasy. It doesn't work.
Well, and Rex, look, the thing is, they've been going to government schools, which have been teaching them that, oh, the progressive era was great and everything about the progressives was fantastic, when progressivism was so discredited that they couldn't even use the word progressive anymore. That's why they came up with the word liberal. Because progressive was so discredited.
Well,
now
they
the word
stole
liberal is
liberal.
So discredited that they're trying to resurrect progressivism.
Yeah, they stole liberal because liberal is our founding thought. I mean, when you want to look at a classic liberal, you're talking about our founding fathers.
quote, mm-hmm. classical liberalism, because it's like not this bullshit liberalism, but actual real liberalism, which our founding fathers were for. But, you know, they were advocating for all this kind of stuff, and they have been indoctrinating students at the government schools that, you know, there was, you know, everybody used to be Vanderbilt. Everybody used to be J.P. Morgan, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so only the government can solve your problems, and the progressives turned freedom away from freedom from government control of your life to freedom from the, you know, captains of industry's control of your life, right? And so now what freedom is more government control over your life. And so, you know, when you're looking at a situation and the government is spending all of this money, all of your money that it doesn't have, the solution to all of your problems is to increase the government every single
which is
time.
Which is why the slogan of INGSOC, and for those of you who don't know what INGSOC is, that's English Socialism from Airstrip 1, which is in the nation state of Oceania in George Orwell's novel 1984. The slogan of INGSOC was freedom is slavery. And that's what
exactly.
we're teaching people now. Freedom is slavery. And by the way, that's probably the third book that we've referenced today. So I would strongly recommend everybody, after you go vote tomorrow, in order to prepare for 2014 and 2016, pick up 1984 by George Orwell, especially read the appendix that talks about newspeak and how words can be used to manage thought, because that's what's happening on television and in our print and in our entertainment media or infotainment media. Get Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley, whose father and brother were also part of this big new, you know, New World Order kind of global one world government crap. Brave New World, both are science fiction novels, but it's really not about science fiction. It's about political economy and political control. And we're likely to be funneled more towards the Brave New World model than the 1984 model, but both are a good read. And also Google Aldous Huxley's speech in Berkeley. I believe it was in 63, but you should be able to Google Aldous Huxley's speech, Berkeley, California. He talks about how he sees the future scientific dictatorships, of which he thinks there will be many, built on the Brave New World model, where people will choose to be happy slaves to the philosopher kings that Plato talked about, except that Aldous Huxley calls them, you know, scientific managers. So that's a very important thing. And then one thing which we didn't talk about, but pretty much our entire conversation has been laden with, is Economics 101. The best yes. book to get started in understanding economics and free markets is Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. You can probably get it on Amazon for $10, and you can actually go to Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S, founded by Lou Rockwell, named for Ludwig von Mises, who's one of the preeminent Austrian economists. Not that he's Austrian, he's actually Polish, but the school, the Austrian school. Go to Mises.org, and you can actually get a PDF free of Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson. These are the things that we need to know, along with how our political and electoral process works so that we can go affect the change. But if we don't know these basic fundamental things that are the core principles of our country and the core principles of conservatism, we can't articulate them, we can't motivate people to go for them, and we can't explain the errors of the other side. So it's very important that we look at these things and we understand them, because as Chris and Tex were just saying, true conservatism, if you're really a conservative, it's not about following the Republican bullshit. True conservatism is about conserving liberal documents.
That's
because
right.
in the 18th century, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Anti-Federalist and Federalist Papers, and the Constitution for these United States of America were considered liberal documents, and that's what we as conservatives seek to conserve. Don't let the labels confuse you. And remember that the real key to success is knowing what your core principles are of freedom, liberty, the right to pursue happiness, and to get along in an ordered society. It's an ordered liberty, which is not an anarchic liberty, although there are anarcho-capitalists and syndicalists and voluntarists mm-hmm. who prefer that model. But even they will tell you there's no way that model would work in our society today because we just don't have the tools. So we have to work towards that true liberty, because if we don't, we're going to fall down the hole so hard, so bad, we may never recover. And people in the future will be talking about the United States the way we talk about Rome.
Yeah.
And it's up to you to fix it.
Milton Friedman also said something in an interview back many years ago. And he said, very clearly, he said, and he saw this intrusion of government into corporations, you know, this control factor. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is the worst thing that could ever happen in a free system, because here's what's going to happen. Government's going to make all these rules and regulations and get their fingers all into corporations, and government will lose, and corporations, business people, free enterprisers who control the money will end up controlling our government. I'll never forget that interview. And that's what we're living today.
Yeah, he kind of knew that, because I hate to say it, but Milton Friedman's kind of like your false libertarian. He talked about a lot of stuff, and he actually articulated pretty well, but then he advocated for some really crazy shit. Like, I think he was one of the ones who advocated for the withholding tax. So instead of having people write a big fat check in April to the government and go, screw this, why am I sending these people 30% of my money? We just take a little bit of time every paycheck so you don't know what the hell's going on. And then when you file your taxes, which you have to pay either in many hours of labor or pay the accountant to do it, you get so friggin' excited because you're getting a refund. Refund? That's your money that you gave to the federal government interest-free, you friggin' moron. They've sucked you into becoming a debt.
You pay a little tax. You don't want the refund. I used to, when I was younger, I was like a refund guy. I was like, hey, free refund. No. They borrowed it from you interest-free, and you gave it to them at current dollar rates, and they paid it back to you at deflated dollar rates because there's inflation in the economy. And so they got the use of your money, and you didn't have the use of your money. You always want to pay a little, right? You don't want to get surprised with some kind of massive tax bill, but you always want to pay just a little.
Or zero. I mean, here's the simple fact.
But let's get rid of the whole system.
Get rid of it. Because the fact is that the only reason the IRS exists, which if you actually look into it, you think the IRS is really, you know, the Department of the Treasury. But the fact is the IRS is a corporation incorporated in Delaware. Now, it does ostensibly operate under the Treasury, but what it really does is it's the collection agency for the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank in order to pay the interest on the debt that didn't cost them anything to create. That's the scam. That's the scam. I know Clint Eastwood said that the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people is Barack Obama. That might be the second or third biggest hoax. The biggest hoax perpetrated on the American people is that the Federal Reserve actually controls the money supply when all they control is debt, and that the IRS collects taxes when they're actually just a interest collector for the Federal Reserve. It is actually the way that it works. And if you want to really understand this, I'm going to recommend another book, but this one is pretty heavy. So only if you're prepared to go into it this deep, is check out The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. And he actually narrates his own book on YouTube, free. So just go ahead, go to YouTube, look up G. Edward Griffin, Creature from Jekyll Island, and you'll actually find him basically reading you his entire book. And also there's a really good movie by Aaron Russo, who was actually, I believe, the producer of Trading Places, the Aykroyd Murphy movie from the early 80s, which is actually a really good movie. I suggest you watch that because it's fun. He produced a movie called Freedom to Fascism. You can Google that, look it up. It explains to you how this system works, where they fabricate the debt, they sell it to us as money, and then they extort interest on something that cost them nothing through the IRS. That's how it works. Ultimately, you're paying, your kids are paying, your kids' kids are paying. We always talk about they're paying in money, but the fact is, how do you make your money? Either through a business or through employment. But what you're doing is you're investing your time and your talent. So when they're taxing you, what they're doing is they're robbing you of your time and your talent, which is really your life. If they're robbing you of 30, 40, 50, 60% of your life, guess what? That means half the time you're a slave.
It doesn't
have to wake
work.
Up.
That's the important thing. It doesn't work. Look, you know, Morgenthau said this back during the Roosevelt administration, right? It's like we tried an unbalanced budget. right? We try an unbalanced budget. That's code for Keynesian economics, which is spend, 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 right? He said it doesn't work. Not only are the WPA and the AAA and the CCC and all this other, you know, BS,
alphabet soup of
organizations that we created in order to employ people, not only does it not work to stimulate the economy, but now we have a huge debt on top of it, and that's a drag on the economy. So our whole program of just employing people to do whatever, burying bottles in the sand is what Keynes said. Just pay people to bury bottles in the sand. As long as you're giving them money, it's a useful economic enterprise because now they have money to spend. That's what he said, all right? What doesn't work? And then on top of having a completely unproductive economy, because what is the market value of bottles buried in the sand? Nothing. Nobody wants that. Nobody's going to pay like, hey, is that one of those bottles buried in the sand? I'll give you $20 if you can give me one of those things. No, it doesn't work that way, right? And he said on top of that, you have a huge debt to boot, right? So now you have this massive drag on the economy. You have subsidized the economy to do something unproductive, and you have gone into debt to do it. And debt, of course, is unproductive money that is sucking you dry. It's like a leech attached to you at all times, just bleeding you dry, needing to be fed. And this gets back to, you know, talking about the debate, this the Jill Stein Green Jobs thing, right, or the Green New Deal thing. You're creating an industry that doesn't exist, right, with a bunch of subsidies. That leech is already attached to you. And then, because nobody wants these products, now you're incentivizing people to purchase products that they don't actually want that are too expensive, and so therefore you're giving bonanza giveaway money dollars to them, their own money back to buy this stuff, but they're stealing it from their neighbor because both you and your neighbor are on the hook for the price of this thing, so you might as well get the thing, right? And you've created an entire fake industry that there is no market for this stuff, and you are paying for it over and over and over again. You know, at a certain point, when do you not realize that you're being had? The solution for spending and going into debt is not more spending and more going into debt. Pour gasoline on that fire. That's the leftist solution. That's what Keynes said. He's like, hey, you got an economy that's basically inflated its way to oblivion. You know what you should do to get out of that? Inflate your way to, like, double oblivion. You'll be fine. Mm-hmm. That's the solution. It's not more
complicated
than that.
Well, then you need a war.
Blow up the competition.
Well, exactly. And so I think that's what people have to understand, and this is where we get bogged down in the surface reason. And look, this is one of the biggest problems that you have when you're trying to do any kind of business transaction, figure out which job to take, any kind of economic calculation. The fundamental problem that we make, the mistake that we make, is one stage thinking. You look at only what's immediately before your eyes without any consideration for the consequences, stage two, stage three, stage four. Sort of like playing chess. If you're playing chess and you don't have the next seven moves mapped out in your head, you're going to lose because your opponent does. So when we get beyond one stage thinking, we start looking further. Well, you know, the one stage is there's a military threat, we need a military response. Or, you know, there's a financial crash, we need a bailout. And we need stimulus jobs because we can see people building a bridge that's financed by stimulus money, but we don't see the 30 other people who don't have a job because it never existed because we sucked that money out of the economy. So we had to start looking that way. So when they give us all these wars, the real reason – now, I'm not saying there aren't threats and there's no reason for war. You always have to be prepared for war. In peace, prepare for war, okay, because you will always have a threat. And for all of you peace and love people out there, yes, we should always have peace and love, but if you're not ready to kick ass, you will be taken over because somebody is ready to kick ass, so you're always ready to kick ass. But that doesn't mean that you do, because the best way to avoid war is to be so friggin' powerful that nobody will screw with you. So that's what needs to be done. But what happens is that they use war because it does two things. It quiets you down, and you are willing to give up some of your liberty for, quote, more security because of the impending emergency. And it also creates financial incentives for those who finance both sides or all sides of any conflict. And like Tex and Chris were just saying, if you blow all the stuff up, then you lend money for the war equipment to destroy it, and then you lend money for the equipment to rebuild it. So it's very, very profitable. So one of the reasons that we engage in wars where you wonder why, like, you know, 9/11, right? Al-Qaeda, which was harbored by the Taliban in Afghanistan, took down the World Trade Center, and so we went to get them. Well, that kind of makes sense. But then we turned around to invade Iraq. Interestingly enough, the plans for the invasion of Iraq were developed in the late 90s, and they were trying to get Clinton to do it. So if 9/11 didn't happen until 2001 and we went into Iraq in 2003, how could the invasion plans have been developed in the late 90s? So, you know, you start thinking about these things. Now we're looking at Iran. You know, I'm not saying Iran's not a threat because those people are, well, they're fucking nuts. And do I want them to have a nuclear weapon? Hell no. But if you're Iran, you're thinking to yourself, look at what happens to the rest of the world. If they have a nuclear weapon, the United States gives them foreign aid and plays patsy cake with them. If they don't have nuclear weapons, the United States invades them and destroys them on top of their leadership. Shit, we need a nuclear weapon. So we incentivize these things because it's not in the interests of the United States that the corporatists operate. It's in their interests. We are merely the host for their parasitic profits. And when it comes to inflation, you would say, well, the Federal Reserve, they don't want inflation because if they devalue the dollar, aren't they using the same dollars? Won't they be less wealthy? No, because the thing is that it's all debt, and the government has to pay back that debt. So the best way to pay back the debt that you can't afford to pay back because it's greater than your total economic output is to make that debt worth less. And the way that you do that is you make the dollar worth less, and the way you do that is you manufacture more dollars out of nothing. When you start to understand these two destructive tools, inflation, the stealth tax, and war, the intimidation tax, then you really start to understand how these things are happening and why the Democrats and the Republicans are the same damn party running the two worst candidates you could ever imagine against each other and telling us that they're so different. And that's precisely why they shut down Newt Gingrich, because of what he did in the 90s. He rocked the boat. He's controversial. That's precisely why they shut down Ron Paul, because he was telling you the truth.
You know, there's something else they don't talk about in the Middle East, Rex and Tex, and I put that video up yesterday or whatever it was about all these pipelines, you know, in this planning. And I saw a documentary, I don't remember if it was a couple of years ago or a year ago or whatever, and they went into in depth. You know, because Russia's issue has always been waterways, you know, just like when they were moving down through Afghanistan and everything that they've tried to do in expanding their empire is getting access to those waterways to the west, you know, and it's markets, it's railroads, it's pipelines, it's waterways. Well, we control the waterways, you know, of the world, and Russia is, you know, is this kind of semi-landlocked environment. And they control a lot of pipelines, and I would bet you money to a dollar that those pipelines, especially in Syria, coming out of Syria and going north, you know, there's some big stuff going on there that people just don't understand.
Well, we're not supposed to understand, Chris. I mean, that's the thing. And look, just to be clear, okay, let's not go down the rabbit hole so much to think that these guys control everything. I mean, that's what they want, and they think that they do, but you have to always understand that ultimately, liberty wins. Free markets win. It's the struggle between winning and the corporatists trying to take everything over that everything goes completely screwy. I mean, one of the most burgeoning free markets in the world was in Soviet Russia. It's obviously illegal. It's the black market. It's not, you know, supposed to be there, but it always happened. There was always freedom.
Yep.
There was always a free market. So these people are trying to control things. Now, are there also dangerous people who want to kill you or invade your country? Yes, there are. I mean, I don't know anybody wants to invade the United States. I mean, I know they're remaking Red Dawn with North Korea as the enemy, which makes
yeah.
no sense. It would only be China, but whatever. But, you know, 1984, the Soviets might have considered invading us. Today, no one's going to really consider invading us as a military force. They're going to invade us illegally. They're going to invade us as guerrillas or terrorists or what have you. They're going to invade us economically. But, you know.
For that, they just buy you. That's what they did
right.
in Rome.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, look, Cato, he used to go into the Senate, and he would hold up, like, bananas or tangerines or grapes or whatever. He said, these were just purchased in the Roman market because the Senate was on the Forum, right? And the Forum basically is Roman code for market, right? These were just bought a block away from from the Senate House for X number of dollars. This is killing Roman, industry, right? And these came from Carthage, and he would give these firebrand speeches, and all of them ended Carthago, Delenda est. Carthage must be destroyed. They're selling us cheap grapes. Let's go kill those guys. That was his whole speech. Same concept.
Yep. It's the same speech we're getting now. And let's understand something, by the way. And I think it's H.R. 347 plus the NDAA provisions in the most recent NDAA that are basically establishing the police state. But I also think we've got some bills that have recently come through, and I forgive me for not knowing the specific numbers and exactly what they are. We'll get that to you in a future show. I haven't had time to do the research because I don't know if you know this, but there's an election going on tomorrow. They've essentially already put in the authorization, because we don't actually declare war. We haven't declared war congressionally according to the Constitution since 1942, when we declared war against Bulgaria as part of the whole World War II. But they basically have the authorization there for military confrontation with Iran.
Yep.
Now, you will say, then we need Obama because, he doesn't want to get in any more wars. No, we need Romney because he's different than Obama. Bullshit. War is coming, whether you like it or not, unless we stop them. Now, that doesn't mean that war isn't necessary towards Iran. I don't think that it is yet, and I think that given Stuxnet and certain assassinations of scientists and all that kind of stuff, there are ways to delay, destroy, and actually make their nuclear program never functional without a frontal invasion. But I suspect that that's not what they want to do, or they simply want to use the threat of war. Because think about it. If they take out Iran and Syria and North Korea, who the hell do you go to war with next? So sometimes they got to keep that boogeyman out there for us, so that there's always the threat of war, wars and rumors of war. I mean, remember, in 1984, Oceania was always at war with either East Asia or Eurasia, because that's how you keep people cowed down and you make your profits. So it isn't about Romney or Obama or their foreign policy. I mean, if you saw that foreign policy debate, the thing that they said to each other more than anything else was, I agree with the president. I agree with the governor. I think the drone strikes are okay. Well, I think more drone strikes are okay.
It must
okay.
be hard
think...
to debate with somebody who has the same freaking policies as you.
Pretty scary.
I'm going to bomb Iran. I'm going to bomb Iran twice. Which one of us is going to destroy things more than the other guy? So it's not going to change. So when you go to vote tomorrow, just think about the consequences. I mean, obviously we can't predict the future, but just look at the indications and the trends. Think about the consequences of that vote, because you're basically telling these guys, yeah, go in there and, take us into another war, debase our currency, and destroy our country. Boost the third parties. We're coming down the last 8 minutes, gentlemen. Boost the third parties. And you saw that debate tonight, okay? I will give this. Jill Stein, crazy as she is, by the way, if you're liberal, please vote for her. She's a good vote for you. Jill Stein and Gary Johnson were in agreement on issues of civil rights, on issues of the unconstitutionality of indefinite detention, on the issues of unnecessary wars. They were in agreement, and it was a principled position. They were in complete disagreement on economics, as they should be, because communism, socialism doesn't work. That's what we've been talking about. But it's important to know that if you don't give these parties standing, if you don't give them a leg up now, tomorrow, it's going to be near impossible in 2014 and 2016. So don't think you're throwing your vote away because you're not voting for the oligarchy. What you're doing is you're sending them a message that they better get their shit together and actually be the parties they're supposed to be. And by the way, I'm not against the Democrats per se, because in 1924, the Democrats and the Republicans both ran conservative candidates. That's what we need to go back to. And we can, but it requires you to do it. Now, if you want to fix the Democrats or you want to fix the Republicans, you need competition to check their duopoly. So you got to give these third parties standing and send a signal to these parties, hey, Republicans, I want you to be more conservative. Hey, Democrats, I want you to be more liberal.
You got
to
send a message in a bottle.
I'm
not participating in this, and throw it out there. And if enough people do, the major parties are like, shit, people don't like us. Look how close this election is, for God's sake. Barack Obama's record as president is terrible, okay?
Mm-hmm.
His actual performance record is wretched. Almost anyone should be able to mow this guy over in an election. I mean, it just hands down, he should be rolling the board. He should be a non-factor, okay? But yet, there's 11 swing states, for God's sake. 11 states. Where's 49-49 or 47-48 or 40? I mean, everybody hates these candidates. Nobody. This is the election that nobody in America wanted. This is the election, and I, you know, put the blame squarely on the Republican Party leadership for this.
Yep.
The Republican Party leadership gave us, forced on us, this shit candidate that everybody said they don't want. And to this day, everybody prefaces, look, I don't really like Mitt Romney, but we got to beat Obama. Okay? That's a problem for you. That is a governing problem, because even if Mitt Romney wins, the Republican Party doesn't even support it. Okay? So your Republican base doesn't even support the guy. And you know what? They're going to run at the first sign of trouble because they hated him from the get-go. Once you get rid of Obama, you get this guy in office, he starts doing a bunch of liberal shit, everybody's going to run from him. You can't govern that way. You cannot govern that way. Mitt Romney is the biggest mistake the Republican Party ever made, and it may be a fatal mistake. And they don't even realize. They think they're walking on water. They're like Wile E. Coyote, and they ran off the cliff. And they're like, hey, look, we beat those guys. I don't know that you did, you know, because that doesn't look like victory to me. Have you looked down yet? Have you looked down? Because you got a big surprise waiting for you.
Yep. All right, gentlemen, we are in the last 4 minutes of the show. So, Trog, why don't you give us your final thoughts, and then Tex and I will bring it home in the last couple of minutes.
Well, there was something earlier that I did notice that I didn't hear Johnson take a stand on before, but that was he took that position of global warming, and I had not heard him do that before, or whatever you call it. Climate change is a new terminology. But I noticed he did it very meekly, so it kind of rolls into some things that we've talked about before that, you know, he's really pandering to the Obama supporters. So it'll be interesting to see when all these numbers come back. But, you know, besides that, I love the economic talk. Always, you know, it's just so – it's amazing how few people understand it and how few people understand the basic foundation of this country. One of the other things that I've always talked about was wall builders. You know, going to Wall Builders Foundation, you know, it's an organization. The guy has probably the largest collection of private writings of our founding fathers, let's see, mid-1800s. And he's been collecting this stuff his lifetime, and he's one of the biggest battlers out there to teach people on really what our country, how it was founded, who the founding fathers were, because they're changing history. And I've always told people you should read books like The Original Intent and understand what was going on in the minds of our founding fathers when they created this country, because they didn't just throw this country together as a bunch of rebels. These were business owners. These were wealthy merchants and farmers and lawyers and educated people who had 10,000 years of history of mankind doing it wrong at their fingertips. They were well-read, and they put this country together. Some would say, you know, the Anti-Federalists would say improperly with the Constitution, but, you know, they were really trying, and it was an amazing piece of work. And since, you know, some would argue the Civil War, some would argue, you know, the Federal Reserve era, but we have really screwed it up, and we should not be where we're at, and we've got to get it back, or we got to move one of the
Rock on. Rock on, Chris. Thank you so much. Tex, to you, you've got 30 seconds before we run out of time.
Sorry, I went too long.
Look, I just want to say that at this point, you know, I'm looking towards the post November 6th day. So the November 7th, what do you do in the aftermath? I don't know who's going to win. I don't even know on November 7th that you're going to know who's going to win because it's so freaking close, and they will pull something. But the thing is, the way things are working, it's not working. okay? I don't think anybody here, even if you're voting for Romney, I don't think anybody thinks that things are actually working for our benefit, and we need to come up with a new strategy, and we need to start talking about 2014 and what we are going to do in the 2 years between now and 2014. So is the key.
All right, so join Tex and Rex, not tomorrow, because tomorrow's election day. We'll be glued to the TV watching results, but I believe that you can check out Robert Jetter, Bar's Logic Political Talk. Tex and Rex will be back at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday for post-election results analysis. And real quick, I'll just close with this. Economics must not be relegated to classrooms and statistical offices, must not be left to esoteric circles. It is the philosophy of human life and action and concerns everybody and everything. It is the pith of civilization and of man's human existence. Ludwig von Mises. This is Tex and Rex signing off.
Right.
The flames of liberty will never die.